Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Hi, you're with Brett King from Breaking Banks. Welcome back to our show this week. We had a very interesting show last week with the neobanks. Lots of very interesting discussion about these alternative choices for checking accounts or the neo checking account, most of them, which of course don't offer checks, which are really built around a strong mobility platform, strong mobile tablet platform, strong audience engagement, and a different distribution metrics. Had a lot of great feedback from everybody. Again, my thanks to the team at Amex with Bluebird and Simple and my own colleague Alex from Movin, who joined the show last week. This week, we're going to be talking about, more broadly, trust in the banking sector. And, is there a way to build a better sustainable banking system? Can we do something to improve the quality of trust and the way the banking system works? So this week I have some great guests. First of all, I'd like to ask Bruce Cahan. Bruce, you're a visiting scholar with Stanford University. Tell us a bit more about yourself and what you're doing.
Brett, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's exciting. In truth, I'm a recovering Wall Street lawyer and Hong Kong merchant banker and geospatial technologist and 9/11 emergency responder and an Ashoka fellow. So I'm too many things. And I'm at Stanford as a visiting scholar in civil and environmental engineering to pursue, a very simple agenda, it would seem, to rethink what a bank is. How people can work with their bank, what impacts a bank can achieve, and how doing all of that makes the bank and its customers and the planet safer and sustainable. And so that's some of what I'm doing. The way we're trying to do that, or we're thinking to design doing it, is to create a sustainable banking initiative at Stanford to study, research, and teach all these topics, to bring together the thought leaders, and how do you know if money is actually having impacts that are sustainable? We now have very deep engineering and health and other science supports for that. And then to build out a prototype and test it in a teaching hospital bank, what I'm calling the Design for Good Bank, which is not an operation yet, just so your listeners know, where we can have bankers and bank financial technologists and others validate that high transparency impact-aware banking does work and makes the bank safer and gives the customers a better sense of what their money's doing when they're sleeping at night. So that's what we want to do.
So how did you come to this? You'd obviously been on Wall Street. You'd been involved in the banking sector. So when for you was the realization?
I had represented.
When did you have this realization that things structurally or fundamentally had to change? That it was almost like it had to be rebuilt from the ground up.
For me, it was at the command center after 9/11, when I saw for the first time in 25 years, New Yorkers could actually help instead of sabotage each other. And I thought, why did it take 3,000 lives, two big buildings, and 19 terrorists to get everybody to look at raising the quality of life or recovering the quality of life? And I thought also that banks had made cities such as New York and other financial centers, in effect, unsafe because of the impacts that they were causing globally that hadn't been taken into account, and that no amount of Homeland Security or other defensive strategies would really change the implicit threat.
Right.
That we changed how banks do what they do.
Now, you know, one of the things that, I often talk about is the trust element. And this sort of is part of this, but I know it's a sort of a slightly different angle because sustainability goes a lot further than that. But, you know, since I think there was always the feeling that you could trust your bank, you know, and that's one of the reasons we put money in a bank instead of putting it under a mattress. But since the financial crisis, it's almost as if the veil has been lifted and people are like, well, I can still trust that my money's safe, but I really can't trust anything a bank's going to say. You know, because, you know, we know that they're just in it for themselves. So, you know, what is there a way to build that trust again, or do you think we've lost that and it's not going to come back?
I think transparency is a large piece of the answer to rebuilding trust in banks. I also think fairness of the bargain is part of the answer. And to do both of those things means being really clear about what are reasonable fees and interest charges and remedies. How are they really going to work? Second, you know, what is the dialogue? Is there a creative dialogue about anticipating and overcoming the life cycle events, whether it's in your personal life or your business context as a business borrower, that challenge this assumption in banking that you can sign a piece of paper and know forever that your life is just going to take a straight path? I mean, that's naive and it's at times predatory.
Right.
And then third, you know, and sort of altruistically, what is it that banks are doing to improve or threaten the quality of life? Because ultimately, as we've seen, that hits collateral value and the safety of the bank. So transparency and this fairness element are key to restoring trust. And the truth is most banks don't have the tools, the technology, the systems, the dashboards to do that well yet. And we can build those if we want.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, you know, you've got this issue where we have organizations like the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, and I know, Bruce, that you've done work with them before. But it's almost as if we're trying, you know, when we're trying to regulate disclosures and things like that, it's almost as if we're trying to regulate ethics, you know, an ethical approach to communicating customers about fees and things like that. You know, is that part of the problem here? Is that, you know, we're having to sort of try and legalize what is the right thing to do? That's not any longer the instinct of corporations in competitive markets?
Well, just to be clear, I mean, I've been in discussions with the CFPB folk. I think it's wonderful that yesterday they managed to get a head of the CFPB appointed out of the Congress. That's real progress. And I analogize it often to how we built the highway system. You know, if we wanted to have a safe highway system, we could keep putting road signs on the highways and just keep making them bigger and different fonts and, you know, brighter lights, whatever. Or in addition, we could build cars that detect when their drivers are being slightly unsafe in how they drive.
Right.
And so you have to do both. I mean, the idea that disclosures in microtype to consumers will help those consumers know what they're getting into isn't the kind of financial literacy that can do the job alone. You have to have bankers and bank systems of dealing with customers that want their customers to win. And that's an agent role that I don't think is out of line with the digital world that we're entering. You're seeing new bank and banking non-bank options like peer-to-peer show very clearly the kind of rates you will be paying and why you'll be paying those rates based on your credit score and other factors. So this is an area that needs visualization and needs, you know, clarity around consequence. But Brett, as we've talked in the past, I think the idea that we're all rugged individualists, that we can overcome any the fast changes, for instance, in the economic cycle that makes certain jobs disappear and new jobs come in. Or divorce or health challenge, all these life cycle events, or starting a business and working it all the way through to sale. This naivety of banks that can happen in the current domain, we have to overcome that.
Right.
And for that, I see banks becoming, and this is part of the key design factor in Good Bank, becoming KTHs, becoming knowledge transfer hubs. And where customers who have gone through life cycle events get to help others who are going through them. And that builds a social capital function to the bank, very much like credit unions and cooperatives in Europe do and or historically did.
So this collaboration element, I mean, obviously we've had social media, you know, it's been huge the last few years, and now you've got digital technologies. You know, are we trying to look for a tighter correlation with people's behavior? Is that part of the solution? If the banking system works more seamlessly within the community or enables individuals better, does that by nature lead to better transparency and better integration from a sustainable banking perspective?
You know, that's a loaded set of questions, but I think ultimately
I'm allowed to do that because I'm the host. I can ask a lot of questions.
I knew I'd be on break. Thanks for a reason, Brett. I think you're onto something. I think what we're both committed to, and so many in this space are committed to, is looking innovatively at the user experience and asking how can it have, you know, a meaning in people's lives which is not manipulative of them, where they get to manipulate, if you will, the consequences and the impacts that they achieve through living. Really six basic functions as we've analyzed it: saving and spending, investing and borrowing, donating and insuring. How do they use those six functions that are part of their financial life to improve their community or improve their own safety net, if you will? Is this something that bank functions and the money that is generated through the banking system could do? And the answer is, from a design perspective, sure, it could. It hasn't yet, but it could.
So I don't know whether you're familiar with Plan Big. Plan Big was a community site built by Bendigo and Adelaide Bank in Australia, which allows their community of customers to pitch basically projects or ideas that the bank can sponsor for the community. So think of the social or the community contribution model. But this is basically where, you know, the community can determine and vote on a plan or a project, and the bank will then say, all right, well, you know, we'll pitch into the community and support that, rather than just having, their community aspects that they decide on. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about from an outreach program perspective, or a community involvement where banks would give back to the community a little bit more directly based on community involvement?
It's that which I've seen in Spain with Calle Navarro, which has been merged into some of the other Calles. It's But it's much more endemic to the underwriting. I think we could have an underwriting model, I've called it quality of life underwriting or sustainable resiliency, where every story that a borrower comes to the bank to tell is sort of ranked for what it adds to the community's quality of life, whether that's a community in Palo Alto or in France or wherever. And so the ability to sort those stories almost like a periodic chart of elements that it takes to build quality of life would be something endemic to the way the underwriting of the loans and the pricing of the loans is done. So it's not an extra bank function, if you will, at the end of the year to make a token investment in community, although there would be pieces of that. It's actually endemic to every loan that's made and a sandwich that's created of the impacts that that loan drives, so that you can have the story of a local restaurant or a local bed and breakfast or whomever fit into the community's quality of life achievement.
So, you know, what does a sustainable banker look like? You know, what would it take to be a good sustainable banker?
Well, he'd be as well tailored as you.
you haven't seen what I'm wearing today, have you?
No, he'd be organic cotton, Brett, and et cetera. No, I think a sustainable banker needs some validation at a place such as Stanford, where they can see that there are many people, including bankers who've been in the current system, that want a culture change and need to develop and evolve what that culture change is together. So part of it is giving them almost like the feedback loops and the dashboards to see what is the impact of the decisions a banker makes, to see that they on Monday make loans that by Friday make the bank safer than otherwise, and also to be able to reward them in their career for achieving impacts systemically that make the banking system as a whole safer.
Fantastic. So look, Bruce, after the next segment with Ben, if you can stick around and come back and the three of us can have a bit of a discussion around how we're going to fix this over the next 5 to 10 years, huh?
Sounds great. I look forward to hearing, Ben. Bye-bye.
Fantastic. So we'll be back right after the break with Ben Rogers from the Filene, I think it's the Filene Research Institute. We'll check with him on that. And we'll be talking about what consumers think about all of this and how this affects the choice of a financial institution. We'll be back right after this break on Breaking Banks.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Calling all CFOs, finance and risk professionals, your call to action is to help your company achieve financial excellence. How? Master risk management, cost control, and strategic decision-making by implementing game-changing technology advances like mobile, in-memory, and cloud computing, and more. Where? Learn from top thought leaders each week on Financial Excellence with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Join us for Financial Excellence with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Business Channel.
Wealth Solutions for the 99% is a weekly talk show focused on helping you develop and execute a game plan to build wealth. Your host, Paul LaJoy, who built a $50 million plus company in less than 5 years, believes it's impossible to be poor in America, and he'll show you why with his innovative strategies. The show is upbeat, fun, and informative.
Tune in every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific on Voice America Business.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. You're with your host, Brett King. And Breaking Banks is a radio show that looks at the disruption in the banking sector. And, whether that's by technology, customer behavior, or changing expectations of the market, what is banking going to look like in the next sort of 5 to 10 years? So it's my pleasure today to introduce to you all Ben Rogers. Ben is with Filene. Ben, tell us a bit about yourself and Filene. Did I get the name right? Do you guys call yourself a research institute, or how do you describe the business?
Yep, we do. It's the Filene Research Institute, and we're a nonprofit think tank, a lot like Brookings or the Hoover Foundation or American Enterprise Institute, but we're very specific to retail banking on behalf of credit unions. We're supported by the greater credit union system, and so we help them to understand issues around consumer behavior, public policy, macroeconomics, and credit union strategies. So the way I always say it is that if it's important for credit unions, it's important to us. And so these kinds of conversations that you're having right now are right up our alley, because these are the kinds of things that will affect credit unions, just like they affect traditional commercial banks moving into the future. And if you don't mind, because I assume some of your listeners may not know credit unions. Credit unions are very, very similar, at least in North America, to commercial banks. Some of the main differences are that they are organized as legal cooperatives. So you have every member is a voting shareholder, and every member has just one vote, and that one vote goes towards electing a board of directors that represents the shareholders' interests and coordinates with managers. And so the functions are essentially the same. You've got deposits, you've got loans, you've got investment products and the like, but you have one less set of stakeholders. There are no outside shareholders. Rather, anybody who does business with anybody who does business with the credit union is a shareholder of the credit union, and therefore the incentives are aligned a lot more, or at least a little more easily than you see in the traditional banking sector. So Filene's been around for 25 years, and we love especially consumer behavior questions, because consumer behavior is changing pretty quickly, and we're excited to help credit unions navigate that change.
So, this is one thing that I've been, privileged to get a glimpse into the credit union world over the last few years with the books and speaking and so forth. And I noted this week, actually, the World Council of Credit Unions is meeting in Ottawa, but last year it was in Poland. I was invited to talk there. And it's interesting because credit unions, they're pretty much the same the world over as you've described them. And it is interesting, in the United States, we have about 7,500 financial institutions, which are savings and loans banks in the United States. But on the flip side, we have about 7,500 credit unions, which probably many people aren't aware of. But the credit union movement is talked about with real passion by those in the credit union industry as something that really differentiates a credit union from a bank. Mm-hmm. So tell me about because banks at the end of the day tend to be pretty much pure profit machines, most of them, because they have shareholders, most of them. Community banks, a little bit different, but the larger banks. So, what makes a credit union different on a day-to-day basis to a bank?
Yeah, so I think, and this is a double-edged sword, I'll recognize that up front, because I am optimistic about credit unions, but I try to be realistic about the downsides of the model. And the upside, I'll start with the upside of the model, is that because the institution is owned by the shareholders, who are the customers, then the board of directors, in almost every case that I've worked with, are very interested in making sure that those shareholders or customers or members, however you want to call them, receive real value. And so we've done study after study that shows that on average, credit union members get a better deal when it comes to rates on savings and rates on loans. That's one of the ways that comes out. They are very focused, and this is especially driven by the board, on service. So you have credit unions, and partly because they are more community-oriented and partly because you see much more of a mandate from the board and from senior managers to really serve members well and make sure that members are well treated, that that complaint resolution is very, very good. And so in survey after survey, whether it's J.D. Power and Associates or American Consumer Satisfaction Index or anybody else who does a survey, credit unions always come out at the top in aggregate of financial services in terms of how
this
much
is this net promoter score and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yep. Net promoter score too. So that's the good side. I think, and I'll try and be clear-eyed about the challenges. Part of the challenge is that because credit unions have this member shareholder orientation, they're sometimes not as disciplined as pure profit motivated institutions. And so you have a lot of credit unions, because there are no outside shareholders, because there are no majority shareholders that are forcing the credit union or forcing management to be efficient and to return shareholder value, then often you do see a little bit of slack, especially compared to banks of similar sizes. And the difference is, even if you did have a more disciplined credit union, that value would still be created on behalf of members and still be reinvested for members, but you don't always see that. And so we talk about that all the time, and we work with credit unions all the time on really trying to figure out what the value proposition for their own members is. But the good news is they have a lot of leeway. They don't have to, you know, do quarterly reports to the market or to outside shareholders. And so they're allowed to take a long-term view on what value means for their members and really double down on that.
So, you know, if you're working on this, you know, you heard Bruce's comments, and one of the challenges, I guess, here is that technology is changing expectations, you know, in terms of day-to-day interactions with a financial institution, whether it's a bank or a credit union. So if you take the best parts of a credit union, but you look at those changing behaviors, you know, how does that credit union evolve? How does a smaller credit union with 50,000 customers or something like that evolve to be able to handle this more responsive platform need that we're sort of seeing that is part of this sustainable banking or is part of this open, transparent, responsive design process, you know?
Yeah, I think that credit unions have that advantage. Again, I'll go back to they don't have to report quarterly out to the street. They don't have to please outside shareholders. So they do have a little bit of leeway in terms of how they plan for that and how they can be engaged with their members all along in making those decisions. But they're still challenged. Their business is like any others where you've got risk aversion. And a lot of times you see this at the board level and even at the senior management level where risk aversion rules the day. And if something is new, like technology that is potentially disruptive comes along, then people say, hey, that's interesting. And it's a lot of fun to talk about it in the boardroom. But until we see proof that it's changing the world and we need to keep up, then we're going to sit on the sidelines. And so in the best cases, you've got a lot of credit unions that are fast followers. But in the worst cases, you see a lot of credit unions that are simply lagging behind because they can't sit out on the sidelines without any external pressure and nobody's going to put them out of business. So that's one of the challenges. And as existing institutions, this is a big challenge too. You have that innovator's dilemma, you know, the famous Clayton Christensen discussion about how disruptors can really begin at the bottom of a market and eat away at the part of the market that existing firms are not interested in because either they feel like it's too unprofitable or not interesting. But I really see this with places like Simple, with Square, with Moven, as you know, Brett, where people or existing institutions don't see a way to make money there. Yep. And so they're happy to cede the market to the upstarts. And that is the right business decision because they'd be losing money serving the market. But it, in the long term, it's the wrong business decision because it ends up taking over from them. So we try and have that conversation with credit unions all the time. But for lots of structural reasons, it's way easier to focus on that part of the market if you're a startup
right.
than if you're an established firm, even a cooperative that's supposed to be doing the right thing for your members.
So your research institute, obviously you guys have done a lot of research about what consumers want from their bank or financial institution. You know, how's that changed? What does the research say today that you think is different, or you know, what's the same and what's different? You know, where's the frustrations, the pain points at the moment, and what do you think we can do about that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, especially as regards this conversation about trust and authenticity when it comes to financial institutions. Survey, you know, credit unions got a huge boost in the wake of this Move Your Money campaign, you know, the Bank Transfer Day stuff. Pretty much the financial crisis was a public relations boon for the credit union system. And so people who otherwise didn't really think much about deposits or where their money sat finally said, you know what, I don't like this or that huge bank. And so I am going to move my money over to credit unions. And so for a couple of years, we saw the deposits flow in to credit unions. And that was a boon. But the challenge is, and this is now that we have come through at least the worst of the recession, and hopefully we're on a long and steady uptick, people's memories fade. And so the reasons that they moved their money or that they were angry with their bank way back when have faded. You know, I've seen research that shows there's kind of a core element of the population that's somewhere less than 10% that really makes all of their decisions based on kind of social responsibility and sustainability. These hardcore people who are members of the Sierra Club and who would go out on a Greenpeace boat if they could afford to. You know, that's the core. And then there's about 40 or 50% of the population that can be swayed by those arguments, but are not necessarily making them as principal reasons for their decisions. And so our challenge as credit unions or as banks, anybody who's trying to set up a socially responsible bank or a good bank, as Bruce talked about, is to appeal to that other 50 or 40 or 50% that really would like to, certainly wouldn't mind doing it and actually would like doing business with a socially responsible institution, but making it easy enough for them to do so. And that's, you know, once the headlines fade and people really aren't thinking about banking on a day-to-day basis, that's our real challenge.
Right. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, things like rate and, you know, in the past, it's been things like local presence. Today, it might be, you know, just purely friction, how quickly I can get this problem solved. You know, these are the really tactical things which drive a decision in banking. You know, today, a big driver is, you know, can I sign up on the website and do they have a mobile app, right?
Yep.
You know, how do we bring the trust element or the sustainable banking element into that so that it is now a credible differentiator in deciding a bank that you work with?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. We did a little bit of research that, that had to do with why people choose credit unions and why people are satisfied. And there's an interesting difference that I think is essential to point out in this conversation. There are reasons that people stay satisfied with an institution, bank or credit union, and then there are separate reasons that they choose to bring more business to that institution. And so, for example, one of the things that definitely drives satisfaction at financial institutions, according to our research, is internet banking. But unfortunately for this analysis and this conversation, our research doesn't show that it drives a lot of decision making. It certainly is important to have, but it's not always the primary driver, where other things, at least for credit unions, things like basic economic things like fee competitiveness and product offered are actually bigger drivers. And so I think that gets to this challenge of appealing to the 10% to people who are going to make that decision because it's important to be socially responsible, where this other thing, the things that we talk about all the time in credit unions like service is a great driver of satisfaction. It keeps people happy, but it's actually pretty low on the list when it comes to having people choose to bring more money over and do more business. And that's a tough one because credit unions and the conversation we're having, we'd like to think that that's going to be a driver for a lot of people. And it's going to be a driver for some of the people. But I think at least in today's world, at least in North America, for most people, it's a satisfaction-inducing element and not necessarily a pure driver of choice.
Mm. So in the couple of minutes we've got before we go to break, I'd be interested really, you know, in your views about the community aspect of credit unions, which has mm-hmm. always been strong. You know, you've had the Fireman's Credit Union, the Teachers Credit Union. You know, credit unions have often been embedded within a specific community, and that's been part of their success. If you want to create a sustainable banking movement or trust, then it appears that that would be a distinct advantage. So now that we've got social media and sort of virtual communities, you know, how do we transition that aspect of community, which is very strong in the credit union movement, to enable something that's fundamentally different than a sort of a traditional banking play?
It's a great question. And we found, the research shows this again time after time, that the more cohesive the original group, then the more ties they feel to the credit union. So your point is spot on. People who, you know, I was just 2 days ago, I was with a credit union that serves county employees in one county of Texas. And it's a very cohesive credit union. People bring a lot of their business to the credit union. It's just the obvious thing to do and they do it. But as credit unions in many cases have become more community oriented or more geographically oriented, then those strong ties tend to dissipate. So I think you're absolutely right that there's an opportunity there to bring these, you know, people who are part of dispersed communities together. And there's actually a mechanism to do that for credit unions. They can have foundations that serve certain causes, and that's one way to bring people together. We haven't seen it yet. We haven't seen it really, really succeed yet. Not because a handful of credit unions haven't tried, but because really it takes a lot of sophistication and a lot of authenticity to really do that good bank thing. Well, I was talking before the broadcast started with Bruce about Van City, a fantastic credit union up in Vancouver, Canada, the largest credit union in English Canada. They have put in a ton of work and do a very credible and very authentic job of being socially responsible and talking about social responsibility. As far as I know, they're gaining market share and doing a great job in the Vancouver market. But I also think, and without access to their income statement, I think that their core business is still pretty traditional financial services. You know, there's a very good halo effect, and it's not just PR, it's very authentic halo effect around the sustainable part of their business. But the main part of their business is still as a pretty straightforward financial institution making auto loans and mortgages. And so the real challenge is to get people who can be excited enough about a message and then show how much you're doing it. But you'd have to do a pretty good job of advertising that and getting it out on social media. The work is there to do.
That's fantastic. So, Ben, what we'd like to do is we'll just have a quick break, and then we'll get both you and Bruce back, and we'll talk about looking at 5 to 10 years. What could we really do with this if we put our minds to it? Sound good?
Sounds great.
Great. So we'll be back just after this break to continue the discussion. Let's have a bit of a futuristic view of what a sustainable banking industry might look like. Back after the break.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
In sales, are you a lion or a vulture? Lions don't wait, they just go for it. Vultures hang around until the lions are finished and just pick up the scraps. How can you set yourself apart as a lion? Join the other aspiring sales lions and listen to Forget Patience, Let's Sell Something with host Ty Maynard. You'll learn the tips and strategies of top sales professionals. You'll gain more clients at a faster rate and at higher margins. If you're a sales professional, business owner, or executive, listen in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
How can we Americans realize our dreams to earn a living? How can you pursue your dream and make money as an owner or an employee?
Learn how at The American Business Person, the online weekly radio talk show hosted by Rich Killian. Today's business leaders share how to succeed and what fails. If you own a new or established business or ever hope to, you must tune in. Join us every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Central, and noon Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. Or listen on demand to our archived shows.
What does a visual workplace mean to you? How does it contribute to operational excellence? And what steps do you take to put it powerfully in place? Listen to The Visual Workplace, Work That Makes Sense, to find out. Each week, Dr. Gwendolyn Galsworth, visual workplace expert and award-winning author, shares tools and strategies to help you make the workplace speak at a glance without saying a word. Learn to work safer, faster, better, and at far less cost, no matter what business you're in. Tune in to The Visual Workplace every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Business.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King, your host of Breaking Banks. This week we're talking sustainable banking, good banking. Can we put trust back in the banking sector? We have Bruce Cahan, a visiting scholar from Stanford University in Palo Alto, also runs the Good Bank Initiative. And we have Ben Rogers from the Filene Research Institute, a nonprofit think tank that specializes on the credit union space. Bruce and Ben, welcome back. So this is the segment typically where I like my listeners to sort of get a view of what it's going to be like 5-10 years down the track. So, Bruce, maybe I start with you. Let's look 5-10 years down the track. If we get this right, then how is this going to impact consumers, both from a technology perspective, a day-to-day perspective, in 10 years' time? Where's this all going to fit? How's this going to look?
So thanks for the crystal ball. I think it's as it's proved in banking and economics, hard to do that, but we're going to do it. And I guess there is the difference. We have lived in a banking system that is very mark-to-market intense. And that means that we're pricing the consequence of things every nanosecond. And what sustainable banking, by whatever name, would look at is some of the science-based measures of what really matters over the long term and how to quantify that it did or does matter, whether that's making a building seismically safe from earthquake, whether it's making a community safe from flood and other climate change effects, whether it's figuring out how people who live in a community that is changing because of its economics and the other drivers globally of that change can adapt and what it can adapt to. So those sorts of models for measuring stuff is what's wonderful about being at a place like Stanford, because in every building I could look at here, and if I go to UCL in London or anywhere, I see brilliant folks measuring phenomena that need to come into banking to assure that what banks fund and the stories that borrowers and target companies for investment tell line up, and that they get credit based on the value of that long-term impact being achieved. So you've heard about social impact bonds as an example. You've heard about, and we've talked on the call a little about socially responsible investment. These are evidence, Brett, of the banking system not having enough capacity to see and to deal with and to price long-term impact. So if I look out 5 to 10 years, I see sustainable banking, and sometimes the Global Alliance for Banking on Values would call it values-based bank, so it goes by different names right now, having the tools to authentically say, we put money where it has a certainty of achieving real quality of life value, whether that's retrofitting infrastructure that's built infrastructure or human infrastructure or natural ecosystem infrastructure. It's giving us that feedback. It's also, if you look at biomimicry and nature and how nature is a design lab and conducts lots of experiments and evolves species that can deal with multiple hazard, multi-event correlations, banks can do that too.
You are
banks.
Sounding very much like an academic there, Bruce.
Well, you know, it comes with the territory, Brad. I think from a consumer's point of view, they will know the deal that they get with their bank as a certainty.
So is this layer of interaction, are we expecting too much to think that banks are going to change their stripes and build this new capability that's sustainable? Or is it that maybe there's going to be something, I don't know whether you call it a filter or some sort of other third party mechanism that comes in between banks to create that transparency? Between banks and the consumer, and whether that's
basically, yeah. I'm sorry, but no, I think we're talking about banks evolving from mere ATMs to being information service bureaus. Right. I suggested a KTH, a knowledge transfer hub, where you get a banking service, but you also get information that tells you why it was safe to deal with the bank and your money that way. And consumers will feel loyal to the providers of that kind of information and that kind of hub, much like they're loyal to iTunes Store or other mediums for getting and using the information they need.
Yeah, I'd add to that. We did, or one of our report authors, I think you've had him on the show or you're going to have him on the show, Ron Shevlin at iTake Group did a report for us that talked about, at a basic level, it talked about these personal financial management software. And he said, you know, this is nice. You know, Mint is very slick and it's nice to see kind of on a budgetary level where your money's going. But he thinks, and I agree with him, that the real win for consumers and what will actually cause the bank or credit union does it right to gain market share is when you go beyond like this makes nice graphs, personal financial management to helps me make good decisions with my money version. You're really going to have a winner. And you know, there's a complex market and lots of people are trying to do it. So we still have to see it. But I think, you know, if I can claim expertise in anything, it's on the retail banking side and much less on the broader market or the commercial market or certainly in investment banking. But I think we've seen, and it's becoming clearer and clearer all the time, that that look at seeing pricing clearly is something that has to change. For right now, most banks, and I include credit unions here, are a black box to their own customers. They understand that they must be making money somehow, but they don't really understand how. You know, a little bit on, well, certainly on loans, but there's so many ways that a typical financial institution makes money that is invisible to the customer. I'm talking about things like interchange on a debit card and a credit card. I'm talking about non-sufficient fund fee. These kinds of things really are significant contributors to the bottom line. And so as you see things like Bluebird that you talked about last week, or I've seen Union Bank out in California trying to put pricing right in front of the customer to begin with, and culturally helping people understand that, yes, it does cost a little bit of money to do business with the bank or with the credit union, but here's all of the things that you can do. And as interchange is threatened and as NSF is threatened by regulation, all of these things I think may either disappear or just be further constrained. I think you're going to see winners on the social responsibility side who simply acknowledge that banks need to make money on the front end, credit unions need to make money. This is how we do it. We want you to come along with us. And that's, you know, it's not just publishing your balance sheet in an annual report. It's helping people understand how
when
they're better
off.
When
you do this, it costs that much. And yeah.
Yep. And how the bank makes money. And people who do that well, I think, are, you know, Bluebird is allowed to charge a little bit of money because it shows value to the end consumer. And it should be the same with almost every banking transaction that we have on the retail side.
Mm. Look, I'm, as you guys both know, I'm very hot on the context of banking. You know, the concept that you don't buy a mortgage, you buy a home. You know, you don't buy a car loan, you buy a car, and that the products facilitate that. So if you think about the way we go about choosing a service provider or a product or even a restaurant today, you know, we get so many community-led reviews and things like that. But if you're in a real-time situation, you're trying to solve a problem like, I'd like to buy this home and I want to know how much it's going to afford, you know, how much that's going to cost me. Or even just, you know, I'm going about my daily life and I'd like to really be able to save a little bit more money so I can do X, Y, Z in the future. How is sustainable banking or a good bank going to be an improvement in that sort of very tactical situation in the future? Part of it, you've already talked about, Ben, about the visibility on pricing and things like that, and we talked about friction, but you know, what's going to separate a sustainable bank in solving those problems for me in the future that we don't have today?
Well, I'll take a quick stab, if you don't mind, Bruce, and I'll let you have the last word, I promise. But I think that we did some other research a couple of years ago about the things that were some of the most important, again, drivers for trusting a financial institution and preferring a financial institution. And the biggest driver of trust was when the institution made a proactive proposal appropriate to the customer's needs. So basically when the institution told
you
something...
They show they know you
and it's clear that it was the right suggestion. That is the biggest driver of trust. Now, this is also a double-edged sword because the biggest driver of mistrust and driving customer satisfaction down was getting it wrong, making a proactive proposal that was not appropriate to my needs. Mm. So there's opportunity here, but there's risk. And I think there's two ways to do it. There's the traditional meet with your hometown banker, sit across a desk, and you just have good advice. And then that's a model I think that's going to live for a long time, regardless of what happens to branches or whatever else. For a long time, there's going to be needs for that face-to-face interaction. But I think some of the emerging models, whether it's personal financial management software or something else, are going to win when they can anticipate needs and make the right suggestion based on algorithms, based on software, that's really just going to help somebody manage their financial life pretty effortlessly. Mm. And that's the next step. And whoever has the best algorithm, I think, is going to win significantly on that.
Bruce?
Well, picking up Ben's lead, I really do think that life cycle management, abstracting it away from, you know, the banking product of the day or week that needs to be sold and cross-marketed. How many of us get credit card offers or car loan offers or whatever that we don't need? I mean, they're just, you know, a scattershot. I think a bank that looks at the six functions that everyone does with their money, as I've said, the saving, spending, investing, borrowing, donating, and insuring, and pulls those together as a triangle and says, you're going to do that. And I know you're being bombarded by internet ads to keep spending, spending, spending. You don't have to, because we're going to reward you for saving and investing more. We're actually going to let that impact your overall relationship score with our bank, and we're going to manage and use the resources of the bank and its customer base, and this comes back to the idea of credit unions and cooperative, to help get you through the changes in life cycle, in a career, in a marital status, in starting a business and winding it up, in getting older, in having health challenges. So instead of treating each one of these as separate product functions with you know, their own frictional costs of offering to a bank customer as a marketing device, look at the person as a living organism.
Fantastic.
And how those functions are in them endemic to just living your life.
Yep.
Bring those together and reward someone who is consciously using those functions to improve his own future as well as the quality of life of the community he cares about.
Absolutely. So a sustainable bank is not only one that is sustainable from an operations perspective, but one that is sustainable from a customer social perspective and really is looking out for the customer, and that's embedded in the culture.
Yep.
Well, thanks, guys. It's been a great show. Very, very interesting. For those of you listening, thanks again for joining, especially following the Twitter comments. Sorry we couldn't get to do any questions today. But next week we also have a very, very interesting show for you. We're going to be talking about building great customer journeys and what it takes to be a great customer experience organization in the banking space. So that's on next week's show. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.